Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Long-term careers in the video game industry are uncommon and are counterintuitively becoming rarer as the years progress. The figures, which are in line with previous GDC surveys, paint a picture of a tumultuous, unstable industry from which employees are fleeing in droves in search of stability and security. For Jay Allard, a former CTO at Microsoft who helped launch the original Xbox before leaving the industry in 2010, the key factor in driving passionate employees away from games is the lack of predictability in scheduling. Quote, "The writing, planning, budgeting, and execution of three-act narrative, whether TV show, movie, book, is far more predictable than modern games," he says. "Video games have always been a more fluid medium with fewer rules and lower expectations on structure. Because of this, a pre-production phase for a game is far less predictable indicator of the schedule, budget, and effort to build. A top-tier producer working on, say, Project Gotham Racing that moves to Grand Theft Auto is going to need to push a very different pre-production phase, even though both games have similar elements." That is in a piece by Simon Parkin in a Gamasutra piece titled The Great Video Game Exodus, and that is going to be what we are talking about today on Waypoint Radio, episode 161. I'm Danielle Riendo, and I'm joined by the full Friday crew today of Rob Zachney.
Hey, everybody.
Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
And Austin Walker.
Hey, hi.
Oh, this is a heavy topic, and I guess we should start with the caveat that we are not professional game developers.
What?
I mean, a few of us have dabbled.
Time to strike that off my business card.
I know, I'm sorry. Take it off your card.
So it shows your E3 a lot, Patrick.
When you know, I beat the hell part of Spelunky, I thought I'd made it.
That was it.
You made a game. A few of us have dabbled, of course, in little things, but, you know, we're not people in the industry in that capacity, so, like, there's a grain of salt element to this, but I think, obviously, we've all been covering the industry long enough to hopefully have a good conversation about this. And personally, this is something I've heard about, you know, for as long as I have been, you know, working in games journalism, is the idea that, you know, people come into this industry young and passionate and excited. They work, 80-hour weeks, and they leave with a lot of skills and aged, you know, 10 years for every year that they have been in sort of the grind. And it speaks to a lot of things. It speaks to crunch. It speaks to, sort of labor practices. It speaks to many, many elements that we will get into. But that was sort of always my perception, is that this has long been an issue in the game industry.
I mean, that's even in this Parkin piece, right? Like, it's a small note, but it's an important note, which is like one of the things that Simon brings up is that when you look at the GDC State of the Industry surveys that come out, what you see is we don't have a lot of people who stay in the game development scene as their career for more than like 6 years,
six years,
I think specific numbers given are 17% of the 30,000 attendees to the GDC worked in the industry for 7 to 10 years, and only 13% for between 11 and 15. And those numbers are not outliers. That is in line with what the State of the Industry survey shows year after year after year. And in fact, like, it hasn't gotten better. It's actually gotten worse.
Which is
6 years is barely a career.
Yeah.
Like, 6 years is like you're still feeling your oats. Like, you're still figuring out, like, is this a career?
Is this what I want to be doing? Totally.
Like, what's often happening is I think people are getting in there in their 20s, hitting the 30s pivot and going, fuck this.
Like,
and I'm going to go, you know, in the story, like, you know, there's a developer, you know, I think it's the first one, the one who was a pianist who wanted to get into sound production, and then they went learned how to be an accountant, which is just like the fun, like, I mean, you know, more power to him. He probably made the right move, but like, just the funniest sort of like, I'm going to go from like young composer to working on games, and it's amazing. Actually, I'm going to go and I'm going to become an accountant. It's just like, Like, it's such a stunning indictment of, like, the video game industry, and it's current, the way it treats its workers, the way this, like, reflects, like, all sorts of, like, you know, problems with capitalism, and it is not unique to video games, but I think video games are unique in some regards, even if this sort of thing, you know, it probably happens in all sorts of other industries that aren't even necessarily exclusive to, like, tech and media. I just think there is a reason we hear about it, like, the drum beaten more often in video games. I believe it's, you know, it's just a more pronounced problem in video games.
Yeah.
My suspicion that, like, the reason this jumps out at you a bit more in video games, or it seems to jump out at people a little bit more in video games, is because the expectations and the motivations that bring people to the game industry are higher than I think a lot of the expectations bring to jobs outside creative fields, where you encounter a lot of this kind of exploitation and abuse. Like, working at a shitty small business, you kind of expect to get screwed there.
Yeah.
And it's annoying, and it's terrible when it happens. It's a miserable experience being exploited in that way. But at the same time, you don't feel like you've been sold a bill of goods quite the same way, I think. Whereas the game industry, it is so nakedly, like, stripping your passion for parts, as it were, that I think it does sort of make more of an impression, the degree to which the industry does not hold up its end of the bargain between, company and the employee.
Yeah. I can say personally, I've met a lot of young people who really want to make video games. That is a thing that happens. I taught some sort of very early, very low level game design classes. I still do at a college in Boston. And there's a whole lot of people who are real excited to go into games. And there's a sort of a bargaining that has to happen between reality and sort of the dreams of the young. That is really heartbreaking sometimes to kind of deal with and to kind of see and talk about. And a lot of folks will do the thing where it's like, oh, you know what? Obviously, AAA is not for me. They'll hear some horror stories. They'll hear about, the kinds of things that we've been hearing about since EA Spouse, which was a while ago now. It was, 12 years ago, something like that, 10 years ago. And still is a problem and still is an issue. And we've had some pieces about crunch as a practice, which is a part of this, as well as alluded to in the piece or spoken about in the piece pretty honestly, about how much how many positions are now contract positions as opposed to sort of stable, full-time benefited positions now at large studios. And now students often will say, well, I'll go indie. And that sure doesn't seem to be a great answer either, unless you're independently wealthy. So,
yeah.
So there's sort of a lot here. I do want to talk a little bit about that contract issue that seems to be a huge part of this piece. The piece does start with a whole story about, as Patrick said, Frank D'Angelo, a guy who was a musician who went in to Volition. He started as an intern at Volition, and he worked there on the sound design team. He worked his way up, and then sort of encountered some changes in the industry. It does sound like this is more of an issue now than it was even in the past, where, something that may have been a full-time position 10 years ago, 20 years ago, is now... That's a 12-month contract, and maybe you'll get benefits, maybe you won't. And people have to then, to accommodate that, move from studio to studio, go all over the country, go all over the world. Honestly, that's more often it's hey, do you want to go work in this city, wherever it is, even if there's a language barrier. And people have to uproot their families. They have to uproot their entire lives just to kind of stay employed full time, which is, man, that is intense.
Well, and I think the move towards contract labor is one of those things that underscores the lack of any sort of guild or union system for those sorts of freelance workers, right? We ran a story recently from Dante Douglas about the kind of where do unions fit in with small scale and contract workers in the industry. You know, we kind of all can imagine what a union might do for people at a mega, giant corporation like Ubisoft with 17 studios. And, where 700 people are working on a game. You can imagine pretty easily what a QA department in a company that size would gain from being unionized. It's harder to imagine sometimes, like, okay, well, what's that mean for a four-person team or a five-person team or for the solo contractor? And one of the places to look for something like that is at the Hollywood models of the Writers Guild, the Actors Guild, Guild, the, you know, the Screenwriters Guild, all the different guilds, the Directors Guild, which set certain standards for guild associated projects. And there's nothing like that in gaming, which means that a lot of the standardization that you can count on as a freelancer or a contractor, or you know, someone who's jumping from job to job, is not available for you in the games industry. And unlike an industry like, and this is one of the things that Parkin brings up, like the tech world, where a programmer could hop from, you know, startup to startup to startup, collecting hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. That just doesn't happen either. So it's like the worst of both worlds. It's yeah. neither the standardization of a guild system where, you know, yes, you might bat your head against some of the inflexibility of that system, but everyone is going to be working at rates that are kind of negotiated and are arrived at collectively. And it's also not the libertarian dream world, the so-called libertarian dream world of Silicon Valley, where the extra money you would be getting makes up for the lack of that or for the instability and for the down periods. Like, the games industry attracts people who are passionate about video games and who are willing to take lower incomes because of that, and it fucking sucks. It's just one of those moments of like, I'm glad we're beginning to see the first sparks of organization. Mm-hmm. And stories like this should be connected to that conversation instead of being presented. And I'm not saying that Parkin did this, but we shouldn't just let them hang as a separate conversation than the unionization one.
I mean, I think it is unfortunate the story doesn't touch on that stuff at all, yeah. because as well written as it is, it's like there's nothing new about this. There's nothing remarkable in this story. It's like a very nicely written, nicely reported of something we've heard a million times before. And I think like the thing that's missing from this is like at the end of stories like this, it's always like, well, hope it gets like maybe hope not next better. Time. Right. And I think like actually what's happening now is like we're starting to fill in those blanks. We're starting to come up with it's not catch all solutions, but it's at least discussions that have actions associated with them that may or could result in systemic change over a period of time. We're not talking about tomorrow or even necessarily the next project, but like there are like steps that can be taken towards discussions that can lead to change, that can lead to solutions. And this piece doesn't have those parts. And like, but part of the usefulness of like, so when I was on Kind of Funny during my vacation 2 weeks ago, one of the questions that came up was someone asking, basically, if I was to take their long question and put it out to one line, it was like, well, if their job is so bad, why don't they just go find another one? Right. Which is like rooted in, like, it's easy to laugh at, but my guess is like, for a lot of people, like, that, you know, this is rooted in like the, oh, it's a passion. Oh, you like making video yep. games. Like, oh, why would you work for a crappy game developer? So I couldn't help but laugh at like someone posing that question, like completely straight faced and seriously. But I think like you actually have to look at that and go, oh, like, rather than mocking that, that's probably reflects like a not a willful ignorance. It's just sort of an ignorance of how like this stuff works, because the kinds of people who know this is actually how the game industry operates are like people like, you know, ourselves or people reading Gama Sutra. Like, it's not the average like person who loves video games. And if they wanted to know, like maybe wants to know more, but doesn't know where to get that. And it's something the video game industry doesn't talk about. So it's like the fact that like someone can still ask that question in 2018 reflects both why this kinds of story needs to be keep being told, even if it's repetitive, even if it's the same story we've heard over and over, but more well written, because like there's a significant chunk of the audience that still doesn't understand, well, if this job sucks, why don't you just go get another one? And this goes beyond just the sort of like, well, maybe you've got a family and you can't uproot them. Like, this is rooted, the industry has perpetuated a lie that like video games are fun, thus making video games is fun, thus everything associated with video games is fun. And like, this is like a Disneyland lie right. that is 100% true. There's lots of fun in all of it, right? Like, you know, there is something that drives people to both do it and stick with it. Sometimes out of necessity, sometimes out of passion, and often out of a mixture of a lot of different contradictory reasons. But like, it is true that it's a lie, and it's true. Like, E3 is part of that lie. Like, the entire yep. video game industry, like both for reasons that are market driven and business driven, like perpetuate a lie that is like creates an untruth for a lot of players that they have trouble reconciling, because where are they supposed to? It's not like you get to the end credits of a game you beat and it's like, so let me tell you how fucked up it was to make this game. And like, I don't expect games yeah. to do that, but like, I don't know. I don't have like a conclusion here as much as like I just well, I mean, like it.
So I think one thing though, this article is explicitly about people who have chosen to leave the industry. Like that's the thing. Like that question is often posed. Well, if it's so bad, why don't you go work somewhere else? This article is explicitly saying here's a bunch of talented people who were good at their jobs and liked working in the industry in some ways, who decided fuck it, I'm right. leaving. And notice every one of those anecdotes. These people are happier. It's not yeah. like they're ambivalent about it, but none of them is saying like, boy, you know, I feel less fulfilled by it. There's a little bit of that, but overwhelmingly the verdict here is, holy shit, like I'm just punching a clock every day at a job I don't care about, and it's fucking awesome. And I've totally been there.
Right.
And right. I think pieces like this do point toward a couple things. They imply a usefulness that will come from organization, because implied in a lot of this is here are people who have chosen to withhold their labor from the industry. Now imagine if all of you fucking did that. Look at all the bullshit that drove these people out of the industry. Have you seen this bullshit? Do you want to keep dealing with it? What if you just fucking left? Or better, what if you and your coworkers just decided not to put up with it anymore? That would be really cool. The other thing this reminds me a little bit of is it reminds me a little bit of the teacher strikes we're seeing around the country.
Right.
In that, and I think one reason you're seeing these teacher strikes is that it's similar in that my mom was an educator for, both my parents were educators, but my mom was a public high school teacher for years and years. So like some real front lines of American education shit. And I think it is similar to the game industry in that, again, you've got a self-selecting group of employees.
Yep.
Who choose to be there because they believe in something about this work. In education, it's even stronger, right? Like, it is, for a lot of educators, almost a holy mission.
Right.
It's not
it's
just
vocational. It's like, it is a cause. It is a mission. Yeah.
Right. And it's not just that you like teaching. It is that you are there for these kids. And right. what is driving a lot of, like, labor action in teaching right now, and I suspect it's why you don't see something like this happening as readily in games. A lot of teachers have been aware for years of how kids are getting screwed in the system too. In how all those like cutesy like bullshit anecdotes about teachers buying school supplies for their students. all of that is evidence of the ways that the people who have the least in the system and who do the most work are increasingly dipping into their own resources to try to patch holes in a broken system. And with educators, it sort of hit a breaking point where, even setting aside the issues of raises, a lot of schools are like no longer safe or like productive educational environments yeah. for students. The mission of an educator has become impossible. And yeah. so that's where you're seeing the teacher walkouts.
Right. Right.
Games, the stakes are, they're like, there's no way that you can make the stakes. The stakes are not the same, right? It's not as altruistic as what motivates a teacher, but you do have some of the same elements of you are dealing with inept management at a lot of different companies, a lot of exploitative and abusive workplace practices and incompetence, and you have a workforce that has chosen to be there and for a lot of reasons will resist acknowledging just how hot the water has gotten.
Right. Well, and there's two other things here too, right? Which is like one of the things that there was almost an educational component to this in a different way, right? Which is that the reason that teachers get upset is because they don't have the resources necessary to do their jobs and educate people. One of the things that's being taken from the industry is the people who would be good at mentoring, the people who, if yeah. their presence was felt and their presence was maintained, could help shape the industry in the long run. But they're burning out and being pushed out, and sometimes by nepotism, as Parkin, Parkin doesn't argue it, but someone in the story does. And losing that, like the kind of like elder statesperson the positions, like not having people who've been in this industry for 15, 20 years, sometimes even 10 to 15 years, is a real problem, because those are the people who end up having the perspective. Like, I'm a big proponent of thinking that you need people in all of these spaces who both have a great deal of experience and people who are incredibly fresh and new, right? It's why I love working with young writers. It's why I like working with writers who have been, who I used to read. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. There is a degree to which those, both of those perspectives produce something new and valuable. And when the amount of people who are coming up in status and sticking around inside of the games industry are so few, it produces this feeling of churn, and it doubles down, it spirals, it's an exponential problem, because one of the things you do when you are in a bad place, when you are mentally exhausted, when you are physically stretched, when you don't know what to do, you turn to mentors. You turn to someone who's been through it already. And when there aren't that many people who've been through it already, and the ones who are have not, it's not been like, oh yeah, things have gotten better, here's how we can change things to make your workflow better. It's often, yeah, I learned to grin and bear it. That's not going to produce a healthy work environment, and it's not going to give those people who are in crisis the sort of support or the sort of action necessary to make the video game workplace somewhere you want to be. And that the thing that is so frustrating to me about this is that it isn't just that individuals see the games industry as a place for fun and for creativity, and they're drawn to it as individuals. It's also a way in which game devs recruit. Ian Williams, who's written for us, and I wrote a piece on Paced Games a few years ago about some Blizzard recruiting material in which, so I want to be clear, everything I've ever read and heard through sources, through people who used to work at Blizzard, obviously it's a company, there are issues, there are, you know, obviously there are some people who are like, oh, I had a bad boss or whatever. But by and large, my understanding from sources and from stories I've read, is that Blizzard is a really good place to work for in terms of economic support, in terms of crunch, in terms of culture. Again, this was a few years ago that I wrote about it, but the way that they pitched their company, the way they pitched, like, come work for Blizzard, wasn't, and also don't, we're not going to, like, crunch you to death. It was, we're all so passionate about video games. It's all about creativity here. It's all about passion and love. We all love video games.
We're a family.
You know video games? We're family. We love you. We're family. Everyone here is friendship, family, love, focus, and commitment. And, like,
those are cult terms.
It's fucked. Yeah. Because if what they're in a position to do is say, we're going to pay you well, and here are what your benefits are going to be like, and we're going to make sure that, you know, we believe in work-life balance. That's like, that's not even that, like, pull the curtain back. Do you know what I mean? Like, we believe in work-life balance at Blizzard. We think everyone should live a healthy life and also get to follow their dreams and build video games. Those two things are, for Blizzard, are a value. And again, I haven't looked at their recruiting material this year. If it's in there, awesome. But they should be making that pitch. Companies that do this should be making it something they're beating their fucking chests about, because one, it should attract better talent, and two, it's good for the industry to make those things values that you should be proud of. And so it's one of those things that if you're at a company that does do this well, please, like, be loud about it. Be clear that this is a thing that separates you from your competition.
There's a, yeah,
and also, go ahead, Danielle.
No, it's okay. I was going to pivot on something else. If you have a related point, I think you should say it.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to what Austin had mentioned before about, like, sort of like the departure of, like, sort of elder statesmen. It's also folks that have been around for a while. They tend to accrue both institutional and, like, personal power and, like, bullshit filters that you don't feel comfortable expressing if you're, like, new, no matter how old you are. Like, and so, like, you know, when we've talked in the past about, like, being frustrated at, like, Corey Barlog's response to, like, sort of, mm-hmm. like, the experience of making God of War, and I remember vocalizing on that podcast, was, like, he's the person who should be in the position to say, like, we should have done it better, we can do it better, because he's the kind of person who can't be fired over a comment like that. There are people who are uniquely situated to express what's wrong, and that comes with institutional power. It comes with financial success. It comes with producing a game or whatever for your company that gives you that sort of, like, halo, even if it's only temporary. And so it's frustrating when those that do have that power and experience don't use it, and when we lose people who are able to accrue that stuff because their bullshit filter tells them, I gotta leave, I can't do this anymore, And this is, you know, certainly true in like games media. Like there's a reason like most of them are like 20 somethings, because the 30 somethings go into PR or producing roles and say, ah, like I'm not doing this anymore. I still haven't taken the hint, apparently. And it's just like when you lose those people, it's not just the mentoring. It's the like those people are in a position to protect the people below them in a way that those who are getting started and are young and don't understand or are willing to put up with things because they're excited and new. Like we lose a lot when they leave that goes beyond just being able to tell someone like, oh, here's how you should deal with it. Like those are the sorts of people that should be in those positions of power. And when they go, like the power goes with them and then shifts to management and administration who are going to make decisions that are not necessarily in the best interests of the sort of like the lower class of developers.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a gendered element here as well, and that is talked about at least a little bit in the piece here. I'll read a tiny little paragraph from the piece. It says, for women, the pressures can be still greater, as well as the challenge involved in working in a predominantly male workforce. People who work in video games, perhaps more than any other entertainment industry, are often subject to online harassment from disgruntled fans. Many women report that the harassment experienced by their male colleagues is further amplified when it's directed toward them by misogyny and sexism. And then there's a story about a woman, Kristen Koster, who started in the late 90s in Ultima Online. She actually started at the same time as her husband and ultimately just had a really bad time and was offered, you know, she was sort of on the, it seems like she was a technical developer of some sort, and eventually management wanted to promote her husband, and they were like, oh, you can be on the live support team. You can basically be a customer service person.
Can't be a direct report to your husband.
That's what it was. And apparently she had, you know, very much put in the same sort of hours, the same sort of effort as he did. And there was like a really clear bias there. So I mean, there's folks who write about this, certainly very, very articulately. I would encourage people to go read things that Elizabeth Sampat has written about sexism in the industry and shitty work practices that, you know, kind of conflate. And there's, of course, always, always, always going to be the issue of women with families. And what happens with them, especially in an unstable field where there are not necessarily great protections in place for someone who has a family and maybe can't move to another country or can't do X, Y, or Z and stay employed and feed their family. So that's another aspect of this I just wanted to kind of mention because it is.
Yeah. It also leads back to the thing that you were focusing on before, which is the contract stuff, right?
Yes.
That like one of the things we work at a company that has great leave for new parents, right?
Yes.
Both mothers and fathers. Anyone who's a parent gets some leave, which is
got to be there for a year, though.
Did you not get
out.
It? Did you not get yours?
You no, don't we, get that.
I thought
you,
we
you
figured out
that.
How to get you yours. While
we figured it, we figured out a wink,
okay.
Wink.
Wink. CL, don't just keep going forward.
CL, keep listening.
Danielle, edit this part out.
Bleep that whole bit.
All right.
We figured it out. But, you know, thankfully, right? But if you're a contract employee, right? Like, if we were all on contract, we wouldn't get those benefits. And that's the same thing with a lot of employees who work in the games industry under contract positions. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to go have a kid, so I guess I won't be around for the end of this project, and that's it. Like, you're not... We're not necessarily going to bring you back for the next project. Like,
also,
that
we
lost...
took your name off the credits. Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Bye.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
God.
Yeah. That has definitely happened.
Like, let's say even if they offer like a really good maternity or paternity leave, there exists outside of the games industry like an extraordinary amount of social pressure to like not take that entire time. Mm-hmm. Like when my wife went on her maternity leave, she was offered 3 months. And she only took the 2 months because we had a long discussion about it. She wanted to go back to work. She was going a little stir crazy, but it was her choice to go back. Going back to work and finding work-life balance. For her, it was actually getting some of her work back into her work-life balance to make her happy. But she had that choice. She works for a company that, you know, does like they make like kids food and stuff like that. So like it was like there's deep encouragement for people to take the time they need. But like that was a unique circumstance relative to what I hear all the time from folks who work, whether in video games or tech or even just wider societal culture, where, you know, the offering of a benefit does not mean that like you are expected or it's going to be smiled upon that you take the entirety of that benefit. This is especially true for like if fathers, which like it's relatively new for sort of like paternity leaves. But like I've heard from all sorts of women who like my wife chose to go back and she wanted to go back, but that is not usually the reason they end up like taking a a shortened maternity leave, and if it's offered, it's because, oh, like, I'm, you know, I'm getting emails or messages about a project, and like, that's kind of like people's way of saying like, yo, do you like you should come back, and like, that's just not fair. That's not like a reasonable expectation for something that is like a hugely life-changing and traumatic experience for all sorts of women when they go through that. And I definitely don't think that's something the video game industry builds into, especially if you're in a game that's in the middle of like crunch or something like that. Like, you know, you can imagine the sorts of pressures that would be on for like, what, you're like gonna go away for 3 months, like when our game ships in November and like you had your kid in July. I mean, that's the sort of things that, like, just not enough discussion happens about. Yeah.
And like, part of that Kristen Koster anecdote is she went to a team that had decent like benefits and PTO, except whenever you try to book it, they'd be like, that's a really tough time for us to do it.
Right.
So you could use your PTO if you just like call your boss in the morning and be like, hey, is today a good day to take off? But that's fucking useless if you're dealing with like daycare type stuff and trying to build some kind of plan. So like those benefits are kind of hollow because you've made them culturally inert within the company. You made it impossible for people to use them as they are really kind of intended to be used when you lay out those benefits packages. Something else this reminded me a little bit of, because another theme in this piece is that there's not much upward movement in the industry. Opportunities for advancement, managerial roles are actually getting scarcer, not more common, even though the industry, you know, is growing and you think it'd be getting bigger. Making those career advances is actually getting harder. And I don't know, it reminds me of, this relates back to the contractor thing, but I can't remember if this was a Washington Post or a New York Times piece, but it was like titled something like A Tale of Two Janitors. This was a few months ago. Did either of you read it? Did anyone read it?
I don't think so.
Can you maybe describe the piece a little bit more and maybe?
Yeah. So it was basically the story of these two women who entered the workforce like 30 years apart. One started as a janitor at like Eastman Kodak in like the 60s. And she ended her career, I think, like either in the C-suite of a major American company or like close to it. But she started like, you know, sweeping and mopping floors. But you worked for Eastman Kodak. You were still part of that company. And like the idea was, you know, if you were in the mailroom, you weren't going to be in the mailroom forever. If you were, right, you know, janitor, you weren't going to be the janitor forever. And the case they're comparing this to is a woman of very similar circumstances who is now working for a cleaning consultancy company or something like that. But basically, it's outsourced janitorial staff. And there is no getting out of that. That leads nowhere. There's no benefits that accrue. Even though you work full-time for this contracting firm, you are not. I'm not even sure that you are a full-time employee of that contracting firm. You are a contractor. You are a contractor for the contractor in a lot of ways. And so the job just becomes this like endless treadmill that provides no avenues for advancement and no ways out. And I think that's another inherent feature to the contractor model, is that there are all these jobs that businesses have to get done to function. There is no way that you can't have janitorial crew. There is no way you can't have large teams, like in the games industry, making AAA stuff in particular, like you need large groups of artists, you know, creating work for assets and such.
Right.
You need large QA departments. But the way contractors are used allows you this pretense of like, oh, these people don't really work for us. They work for someone else. And because they don't work for us, obviously we would never advance them within the organization because they're not part of the team. They're not in the organization. And we don't have to provide benefits. And I think this is something you see across more and more of the economy, is that it's getting a job is not that hard. Getting a career that feels like it will actually go somewhere is becoming really fucking difficult and really scary. And I think that's the other element running through the story, is that people are looking up. Like 10 years ago, you know, you join a team and you could tell yourself that with time, maybe you'd be, you know, a department lead or something, a systems designer. I think if you're joining now, it sounds like a lot of people in this article are sort of looking up above them and realizing the opportunity is never going to come their way. And when the opportunity does open up, it's going to go to somebody with a personal connection.
is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Totally. The piece you're talking about is called To Understand Rising Inequality, Consider the Janitors at Two Top Companies Then and Now. At least that's what the head is now. Probably changed since it was first posted in September. So give that a read. It seems interesting.
There's Dude, you another- read about like... Sorry, just the vision of what it was like to be like a janitor in the 50s or 60s. Utopian compared to now, because at least you could work for a major company and like get your start that way. Yeah. Sorry, Daniel, you were saying.
No problem. I mean, it's really, I've watched some recent like organizing in the 50s. Like, your union is great. Like, if you worked in a factory I've watched some recent things lately that was like union kind of propaganda, but I don't mean that in a negative sense, old videos. And it's like, wow, that was in this, like, in the last 100 years. This was how people felt about things. But yeah, I wanted to mention part of all of this, and part of the reason why it's so hard for people to change jobs and change places where they live and change all kinds of things is also due to healthcare. Another sort of like conflating issue in America, where, you know, maybe it is sustainable in some places on this earth to work a contract job, to have the money you need for rent and have benefits because you live in a country that takes care of you on some level, or at least has some of the basics for living as a human being. you know, sort of like, okay, I think about this all the time, maybe because I'm an EMT, but if you get hit by a car, I've been very lucky in my life to have full-time employment and part-time employment the entire time I've been an adult, and had benefits and had healthcare. But I see things like people who don't have health insurance who, you know, can't afford a ride on my ambulance. We are volunteers and we won't charge them anyway. But you know what I'm saying? That they're terrified that the ambulance will take them to the hospital and they'll be bankrupted even if they have, you know, extreme horrible injury, which is, you know, another we could talk all day about how we
that is happening
to my
parents right now. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Literally. Yeah.
This is a very, very fucked up and real thing. Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Rob.
No, I mean, you can be put in an ambulance. Like, doctors can be like, no, we can't actually let you be driven to this other hospital where we need to, like, do a CT scan. Like, you actually need to, like, be loaded into this ambulance. And then, like, right now, my parents are, like, trying to fight, like, a $6,000 ambulance ride bill. Because, like, my mom slipped on some ice in, like, rural Michigan. And a lot of ambulance companies charge by the mile, and they charge a steep fucking fee by the mile.
And the EMTs
so, like,
who work on it get less than minimum wage. And
yeah,
it's like,
no, for
yeah,
sure.
Good job, but ambulance companies. Yeah. Sorry.
But also, like, it would be nice if we had, at the very least, if we're going to move into this sort of everyone is a contractor hell, some sort of, like, large scale, like, carried benefits expectation and structure, like the guilds have in Hollywood, would, I think, ameliorate a lot of this, at least. Like if the days of people being, like, you know, lifetime employees of a company, of, you know, putting in your 20 or 30 and getting your pension, if those days are gone for good, at least maybe we can move into this model where, like, you accrue benefits as a contractor that are yours. And they're not dependent on you being part of any one company because you're part of, like, a trade or a guild. And for someone to get access to your labor or someone like you, they have to agree to these standards and practices.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that we don't see at all and don't really talk about that much is, you know, this industry is unique in some ways. But not unique in many other ones. And there are situations where platform holders, you know, whether that is your mobile phone company, you know, your Apple, your Samsung, I mean, even in games, around environmental protections, around agreements not to use, for instance, slave labor, right? Yeah. You'll find a list where it's like, here are the things that we do to ensure that we are not using conflict minerals, right? companies around the world could be better about all of those things because they are, of course, companies. They are, of course, capitalist organizations. But we never even talk about the notion of a Sony, a Nintendo, or a Microsoft saying, like, yeah, we're going to put together some guidelines for things that publish, even inside of their, like, first or second party studios, where they'd be like, all right, yeah, for our internal studios, here's what the minimum is. Here's what our standards are. I can't even imagine. This is the fucking most dystopic thing about this. It's like, I can't even imagine Nintendo or Microsoft or Sony saying, you know what, there's going to be a limit to crunch. Or, you know what, crunch always needs to at least have X remuneration involved with it. Or if you're going to work with contractors, then XYZ, right? Yeah. And they're in the position to do that, but it's not even talked about. Which I'm not saying here's my favorite list. I'm saying, hey, what if we did talk about what those companies as platform holders could do with the companies they're willing to work with? Because I don't expect it, but like, it's maybe a venue, a direction to start thinking about.
Oh my God. I read the comments. I read the comments, guys.
Oh no.
Oh no.
No, Rob, don't
I need
do
to
it.
Read one. I need to read one.
Okay,
I'm not going to give this guy's name, but.
Okay.
As someone previously pointed out, bad work conditions can be found in pretty much any sector of the workforce. Corporate USA is worse, as I discovered firsthand early in my work history, and this awareness carried me through some pretty bad jobs in the game sector. But I see the negative aspects of the game industry as serving a useful purpose for all developers. It filters out those who are not that passionate about games, and you often learn more from mistakes than easy success.
Oh.
Go fuck yourself.
If someone like that, if someone ever talks like that around you, like, be assured that person will throw you under the bus.
Pulled myself up by my bootstraps. My parents gave me a $15,000 loan.
Yeah.
Sounds like that kind of person.
I feel like the Donald.
I made my way through college. My parents paid for it.
It's
It's hard not to feel defeated. It's hard not to feel like exhausted. You know, you ever hear it take so bad?
Like, what, you don't believe in the American dream? Is that what you're saying?
What a person like that is bringing to a comment like that, though, is again, it's this sort of old model of, well, everyone has dues to pay,
right?
And one, I always think like, probably people don't need to pay all the fucking dues that, like, previous generations did. Like, that's kind of bullshit. Like, what if nobody asked to pay dues? Except union dues. Pay those. Those are good.
Yeah, those are all right.
But I think that's one element of it is this idea that, like, well, you know, if I had to eat all this shit, everyone else should too, before they can get where I've gotten, or else they don't deserve it. And two, again, like, you're still kind of buying into this idea that dues paying is going somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, oh yeah, your first few years in this industry suck, but once you're sort of through the worst of it and you're no longer entry level, then, you know, it's all green fields and high tides, basically.
I mean, that's like the medical model, right? Of like, mm-hmm. You go through hell for you go through school, you go through your 4 years of school, then you go through hell in your residency, and then you'll get paid decently and have your specialty and you've done your 10,000 hours of training and here you are. And obviously it's a very different field because you can expect to have a job as a doctor, at least if you are not, you know, if you didn't fail out, basically. You can expect to have a job somewhere because that there's a need for that type of labor, obviously. It's really frustrating to see someone say that. Of course, somebody will. I think we all probably expected to see comments like that, whether or not this person actually did pay their dues and did, do the thing that they said they did is up for debate. But it also speaks to this just absolute lack of sort of empathy that, you know, is a cultural phenomenon and maybe a human phenomenon if you're asking me on my worst days. But the idea of, like, we can't make it better because it's been bad. That sort of giving up, that sort of failure.
It's like a lack
to...
of political imagination.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
This, like, when I said... kind of funny that capitalism is bad, and then like half the comments from the negative people. There's a lot of really good comments, but we're like, "What? Do you realize you have your job because of capitalism, jerk?"
Okay.
Well,
fuck, you got me. Shit.
Damn. Oh. I participate in the flawed system because that's my only choice. Fuck.
God,
damn it. You
damn
got
it.
Me.
Also, the existence of a market doesn't necessarily imply capitalism, but whatever.
Yeah, people are very – yes. I think about that lack of political imagination a lot, and it can be – it's frustrating because I do my best not to hold it against individuals, because that – the not being able to see outside of the current moment is something produced by capitalism and by the culture. Like, it is, people are taught not to imagine something different. But like, it's really good to imagine something different, and it can be very productive, even if you're generally cool with the system as is. Because even if all you're saying is like, oh, even if you're the sort of person who's like, I'm liberal and I want capitalism, but I also want healthcare. One of the easiest ways to get better, to make sure that system of healthcare is better, is to dream about how good it could possibly be, and then scale it to whatever your less imaginative, less radical vision is. Like,
you move the goalpost so that you end up somewhere,
right?
Still
somewhere,
forward,
yeah, a step right? forward, like, yeah.
somewhere,
yeah.
And it's so frustrating to start at, well, what we got is okay, instead of always what we got could be better. We could do better than this. We could always do better than this. And we're going to push to do better. And we're going to keep pushing to do better. There isn't an end goal. There isn't a like, well, done. Like, there isn't. This stuff doesn't just take time. This stuff takes like continued effort.
And vigilance.
Forever. Vigilant. Forever. Like, that's not a problem that needs to be solved. That is what it is to be alive and to have a job and to be in an industry or to be active politically. It isn't like, all right, this arrangement is as good as it's going to get now, XYZ. It's always be thinking about how we can make sure that our workplaces are safe and are equal and are places where people are being paid fairly and that benefits are being equally distributed or being secured, you know, correctly. Mm-hmm. And that's not something – it's why you need people whose job it is to do that stuff, you know?
Yes.
Huh.
Yeah, exactly.
I had this experience. My main experience being a contractor was at my second job when I so I worked for 1UP, and then I went to go work for MTV News, which is MTV Multiplayer, like their blog. But I also worked for MTV News, and like I didn't quite understand what I was getting into at the time. But I was, and that's no fault of the people I worked with. This is just how MTV structure worked. If you weren't like one of the primary editors, you were what they called a permalancer.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so permalancer, if people aren't familiar,
I want to be really full stop. Vice uses that terminology internally also. That's a common term in media. I'm not doing it to undercut whatever you're about to say. I'm just like full fucking transparency.
It's a common thing.
It's a common thing
in the media industry.
Yes.
It's basically, so the way permalancer works is that you are technically a freelancer, which means they don't have to pay you benefits, you have like a negotiated salary that is paid out like on a time card on a weekly basis. So you're like still filing like a time card that is like based on hours that you like are charging, but you're not a salaried employee. So that's why you get permalancer, because you're sort of like this perpetual freelancer that has a continued agreement. It's bad, but it was like, I took it at the time I was 22 and it was a really big position for me to move up to. But so also it makes you the part of the reason it's not just to not give you benefits. It's also because like you're easy to like kind of scrub aside when things get bad. So when the 2008 financial crisis happened and MTV was going through like their first round of cuts because of like, what, you know, the financial crisis was happening.
Yeah.
If you lose your job as a permalancer, like you don't get any sort of severance, like it's just gone. Like the contract is just null and void, and like you don't have a job anymore. Like you have no money, like you have no health insurance, like, you know, or whatever you're paying, you know, you're paying for the health insurance on your own. So I guess you still have that. But all that stuff just disappears in a cloud of smoke. And fortunately, like when MTV decided internally that when the financial crisis hit and they had to start doing cutbacks, they were just going to get rid of all of their permalancers, but they weren't going to tell them in advance.
Oh.
And so I ended up fortunately finding out, like Stephen Tisolo is a wonderful human and a boss that I have had the pleasure of working for a number of different times. Like he called me when he found out and said basically like, here's your 2-week notice, like you don't have to write anything, like go find like other work or at least like start getting a head start on stuff like that. But like I don't know how many people got a heads up about that. I would presume lots of people did not get a heads up about that, but I basically got like a 2-week severance to try and figure it out because my boss was like responsible and like kind enough to be like, wow, that's kind of fucked. Like our internal policy is going to be, we're just not going to tell people.
Yep.
And I'm sure for lots of other people, like they woke up on like a Monday or a Friday or whatever it was and were just like, oh, I just don't get checks anymore. And like, that's how like contracting works. And like, that was my like experience with that. I've been fortunate to, you know, I've done freelance off and on when I've been laid off or left jobs, but like that was my one and only sort of like exclusive sort of contract experience. I was there for like a year and change and bad.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, the gig economy, not great for anyone.
I mean, great for capitalists.
Oh, yeah. I guess great for the people who own the company that is being, the people who are being exploited. But
someone's labor time, then you can get it real cheap these days. So.
God damn.
Uh-huh.
I think that's, like, this is one reason I just don't have a ton of patience for arguments, like, for the benefits of these systems, because the benefits are almost always, like, yeah, somebody's benefiting. I'm not blind to that.
Right.
But
yeah.
I don't have a lot of patience.
It's not me.
For it. Yeah.
Right.
It's not like, you.
This idea that, well, this is part of what contributes to a dynamic economy and allows companies to take more risks. And there's an element of that. But should that risk always be borne by the worker and not the company, right?
Right.
Like that's
right.
That's one of the really frustrating things. Like this stuff becomes a lot less abstract when it's like January 14th and you're on the phone with a major client, and over the course of that conversation, in their roundabout way, they break the news to you that like a $12,000 contract has just disappeared.
Right.
$12,000 a quarter is now just up in smoke. And now you just got to plug that gap. That really like concretizes
the
these
thing,
issues.
The other thing that could happen to freelancers and contract workers is that $12,000 contract becomes a $6,000 contract. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to still do 60 or 70% of the work, which means you're doing more. Not only more for less, but you're doing more than you can comfortably go find a second gig to fill that space for. And like that shit happens constantly and it's infuriating. I don't know. It is a tough thing also, I think, because one of the things, like you said, Danielle, in this piece, you know, we get to the Kristen Koster story and the gendered harassment and harassment in general in the games industry is so fucking bad. It is so frustrating to me to see devs dogpiled because a game doesn't have a feature or because a game has women in it, like with Battlefield 5 last week or 2 weeks ago, or because a game's ending isn't as good as you hoped it would be.
Or if a woman developer prefers certain types of gameplay over another, for example.
For instance. Yeah. Right. And same for journalists, right, and critics, right? We definitely have been on in front of the social media harassment firing squad. Yeah, exactly. And it's so frustrating for the reasons outlined here, which is no one's doing this because it pays well. If we were in it for the check, we'd be somewhere else. And I mean that for people on all sides of the industry. Like, if you're good at your job working PR at Ubisoft right now, you'd be getting paid more at a different tech company, probably. And like, I know Ubisoft PR people, and they're happy there, and but they love video games. They fucking love video games, and that's why they're doing it. It's not like, yes, they're. I'm not saying they're not well compensated. I'm not saying like pay Eric Pope more money. I guess he's Community, but you know what? Also, hey,
pay
you
Eric
know what?
Pope more
pay
money.
Eric Pope more
pay
money.
Pay Stone Chin more money.
All of our Ubisoft people out there. There is a situation where it's like a lot of times those people, and often women who are in community positions or in forward-facing positions, in PR positions, and often sometimes in dev roles too, in writing positions, in programming positions. We saw this a little bit coming off of BattleTech with the pronoun stuff, and the lead designer on that game is a woman. Sending hate at them often comes with this notion of like, you're so like successful and rich, you're in the games industry. It's like, yo, everyone is making rent. Everyone is just barely making rent. You know what I mean? The money here with the skill sets that you have or the time you've put into it, go be an accountant, you know? Like, you can go be an accountant and you'd be making way more money. So it's so frustrating to see the kind of the ongoing myth that everyone is like so comfortable inside of the games industry, and that somehow gives angry fans enough of a legitimate, you know, reason to be shitty.
Yeah. I think this podcast hopefully has made people mad. That's what I'm kind of hoping, honestly. I hope people are mad.
Right?
Not at us. No, God, please. Not at us. Don't shoot the messenger. We don't typically do this, but I feel like we have touched on so much about labor and so much about, you know, issues that, again, if you are just a video game fan who maybe just listens to our podcast and isn't aware of other stuff, are there any resources that you folks can think of that are like entry level learning about fair business practices or fair, you know, sort of learning a little bit about labor and how it works in America and what you can kind of do about it? Are there any resources that we want to actually point folks towards in this?
If you had told me this was a segment, I would have gotten some together.
I'm sorry. I just thought of it.
If you give me heads up, if you give me some time, I can give you a list for the show notes.
Yeah, we'll have something in the show notes. I'm just thinking about it as like, okay, this is making me pissed off. Hopefully it's making other people pissed off. And, you know, here's the thing to do.
Well, at least like go support like what's now I'm blanking out, the video game unionization.
Game Workers Unite.
Yes, Game Workers Unite.
Yeah, Game Workers Unite. Like that's like those are folks that you can get in touch with. Like they have a website. They have a Twitter account. Like,
yeah, I can actually say that the Game Workers Unite resources page is really strong in terms of giving you some introductory reading on stuff from places like the Economic Policy Institute and some stuff from, I think, from SAG-AFTRA and from Ian Williams, who, again, has written for us. He wrote – okay, here's an easy one. Ian, if you're like super like, hey, what is a union? Ian Williams jumping off of a now famous Dan Reichert tweet, which was him saying – this is years ago now, basically – but saying like, I don't get what a union is or why there are unions.
Oh, I remember that tweet.
I was at Ibotta at the time, and I saw an opportunity to engage. And so we had Ian Williams, who is a great writer, dig into what unions are and why they exist and, you know, what you get from them. That piece is called Now You're Working with Power. That's a bad headline, but I guess it's a different situation when you're writing to an audience that's just like, oh yeah, we're the giant bomb audience. Yeah. It's a different thing than trying to just get everyone on the internet. Anyway, it's called Now You're Working with Power. And that's a really great introduction to like, what is a union? How do unions like work? Et cetera, like directed specifically to an audience like you.
Awesome. And Game Workers Unite resources page is just gameworkersunite.org/resources. So that's an easy one to find some good stuff. All right, cool.
Now I'm just imagining like Ian explaining labor politics to Dan Reichert though. And like, so when the boss does
podcast.
His heel turn, the union comes running in from...
That's really
good. I
do good.
Search for heel and it, yeah, actually. Honestly... I mean, there was a union faction in the WWE for a while.
Oh, wow.
Which is terrifying because of the WWE's own history with unions. It's really – it's so fucking –
yeah.
You know what is a good thing? Another thing that this reminds me of is – what was the thing? Kieran Gillen, when he left games writing. Sorry for the tapping. I'm trying to find this thing right now.
No. Please. I'm just laughing at – when blank left games writing.
Yep.
But he was talking about basically, yeah, so it's on leaving RPS. So when he left Rock, Paper, Shotgun, I think, to go full-time as a comics writer.
I was going to say he went to comics, so I don't know that like there was like jumping ship to accounting.
Well, yeah.
No, but... no, except that other creative industries, this is what I mean when I say like we do it for the passion. Like it... Other creative industries often do have writers' guilds, do have a longer history of stability. Like, obviously, if you're still freelancing, there's still – I'm not saying that things are perfect in the world of comics by any means. But those histories – those companies are – you know what? I don't want to get into it because I can think of too many ways which Marvel and DC specifically have fucked up recently. But that's not where Kieran went. So it's – anyway, I'll let you continue, Rob.
No, but – So he sort of gives this parting message to other games writers, but I think it applies to a lot of people in creative fields. And he sort of says, you could even end up in cold financial terms better off than the capitalism uberalis wannabe publishers. I look at the generation of writers directly before me, and the richest one isn't the one who fell entirely in with the corporate line. It's a brilliant, insightful writer who was minority shareholder at a games company who sold for about 100 million quid. As I said, have some pride. You've got talent. You're using it in a stupid way. And when you smarten up, you'll go on to do great things. Do not listen to your bosses. They will infect and ruin your brain. They don't have your best interests in heart. Who profits from making you hate yourself? They do. The less you realize how good you are, the more they can profit from you. And they do. And they will. And I think that's right. Kind of, that is a piece that left an impression on me. I've never quite forgotten it. And something I return to every time I hit a crossroads in this field, because like, I have met some of the brightest, most capable, and compassionate people of my life in this field. And almost all of them deserve better than they get from the compensation they get as a part of this field. And I am 100% on board with people keeping that in mind, that you're not actual, that your value is not what you get in your shitty exploitative industry. You could and will do better somewhere else. You have the talent to succeed elsewhere. You are never as trapped as you think you are.
That's a good message.
I like that message a lot.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, we're at an hour. I was going to dip into the question bucket, but that actually feels like a really good place to end things today, I think. That's a good note. And also, like, hey, in general, like I always, you know, we say at the end of the show, be good and be good at it. But also, don't treat human beings.
Peace. No. Okay.
Cool. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Beans. Oh, no, I wasn't.
Sorry.
I wasn't ending
my activation
it.
Phrase.
I was doing it. Yeah. I was looking at the camera. I was having that moment of like, hey, kids, listen up. We say be good and be good at it, and we mean it, but also don't treat other human beings like objects. Even if the world treats you poorly, try to be a better person. Try to be the bigger person. Try to make radical empathy part of your life.
God damn it, Rob.
I love you, Rob.
Fuck you.
God damn it.
It's very good. If you do have questions, you should send those to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. And maybe you'll have questions today. You know, I have questions. I've got to go do some reading. Go to that resources page. Shoutouts, of course, to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. And you can read everything we write, including that awesome piece by Ian Williams, at waypoint.vice.com. Thank you all so much for being here, for listening to us. Austin, where can we find you on the internet?
At Austin_Walker on Twitter.
Patrick, what about you?
At I'm still mad at Rob.
Good. Rob, where
at Rob Zachney.
All right, good. He went with the straight answer this time. All right. I'm at Danielle R.I., and I encourage you to be good and be good at it and support union efforts.
Peace.
So are we calling a timeout?
Oh, my God.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.